focusing on German and Soviet studies and American Cold War diplomacy.
Not wanting to teach, he left academia to write. In 1994, he became interested in the UFO issue. He was intrigued by the cultural schizophrenia. Mainstream academic culture continued to treat UFOs as amusement, while many intelligent people privately took it seriously.
Throughout 1995, 96, and 97, he conducted a systematic bibliographic search, hunting down the many out-of-print books and UFO documents released over the years through the Freedom of Information Act. He found the amount of information nearly overwhelming, which it is. A detailed chronology of relevant events was prepared in advance of writing his critically concise historical narrative of the problem. He will soon embark on the final volume of his UFOs and National Security State trilogy, which will take the story to the present day.
He's the only speaker to present at all five X conferences. Please welcome Richard Doland to X Conference 2009.
Great to see you. How are you? Can we get this back up here so I can... How do I do that?
Who? Steve. Steve.
We have a laptop situation, people. We don't know how to open this laptop.
It's got a catcher somewhere.
It's an IBM ThinkPad. Right
here. Oh, there it is. There it is. Found it.
Awesome. Great.
You're the best.
All is well.
Hello, everybody. Good morning. If I move away, you can't hear me? Am I? Okay, I'll take care of this. It's a great, great honor to be here. Stephen and Cheryl, thank you very much for the introduction, and thank you all for coming here. Yes, I've been to every X conference. I hope to keep that record going, and the only way that I'll keep it going is by publishing this book that I have promised the world for so long. I want to talk a little bit about that. As Stephen and Cheryl mentioned, I got into this topic about 15 years ago, not really with any preconceived ideas, to be honest with you. I was studying history, doing a PhD in Cold War studies, and I got hooked on this topic. I just, on a lark, I thought, I wonder if there's anything to this phenomenon, and if it was a mistake on the part of these generals, if they ever did take it seriously, then why have I not read about it in any single academic history book ever? I mean, would it not be interesting to go back to 1950, be a fly on the wall in some general's office who's speaking about airspace violation by objects that can't be identified and so on? I thought, well, that's quite interesting. So I thought I would take out about 3 months of my life to look into this as a private matter, and that's when I got hooked. So I wrote UFOs in the National Security State. It was a while ago. Remember that asteroid that killed off the dinosaurs? Remember that? It was a couple of years after that. And so then I took that up to 1973 and felt like a guy who ran a marathon and just collapsed at the finish line. But then I realized I had to do this other research. And now, guess what? I have finished. This is the good news. The bad news is the book, known as Volume 2, is not available today. The good news is it's done. I'm happy to say that. I'm also happy to say that I'm very pleased with this book. I've become a fan of the topic that's encased within it. And I want to talk about that to you today. The other thing I want to say about this is I'm really hopeful that this new book, The Cover-Up Exposed, dealing with 1973 till the end of the Cold War, 1991. It is my hope, it's my belief, that it will become a very useful tool for any student of this topic. I think it will be a useful tool for those of us who are interested in fighting the cover-up. Because what I've tried to do is tell a reasoned story about just exactly what went on during two critical decades in modern history relating to the UFO phenomenon and cover-up. So let me, without any more waiting, let me talk about this book. And, I'm sorry. Okay, great. I'm going to wait for this here. you're not seeing me.
Tell me when, Ron. Tell me when you got it.
This always happens to the first guy on the lineup. Okay, so. Okay. I've got a couple of major themes in this book, so let me get into it. Obviously, the first part of this book, or the first aspect of the book, is just UFO sightings. Just like the first book that I wrote, it's somewhat encyclopedic in the sense that if you had a question about, oh, I wonder about that sighting in 1986 over Alaska, well, then you could look it up. And you could find, hopefully, everything that you need in a concise but yet thorough format that will be useful for you, with as much up-to-date research included in the citations as possible and so forth. Now, among those sightings, there's a lot of emphasis on military encounters. It's not exclusively. A lot of sightings I've included in this book that are just good sightings. They're interesting, and they needed to go in. But there's a lot of military stuff in here, not only American but international. In fact, I would say more of an international flavor than in the first volume. And the reason is really having to do with the data that's available. In the first volume, during 1940s and 50s and 60s, most of the data that was available was American, not so exclusively in later decades. And so I was happy with this. It's a much broader-based look of international military encounters with UFOs, American, Soviet, British, French, South American, Australian, African, several Asian Chinese encounters as well. They're all in there. They're all quite interesting on their own merits, and so they're in. Then the second theme, there's really three major themes of this book. One is the sightings, and then the second is what I might call the geopolitics of the phenomenon. So that would include government and military responses to the UFO phenomenon. To what extent can we ascertain how these agencies dealt with the problem? Well, it turns out they dealt with it in a very serious way, as far as we can tell. The other aspect of the geopolitics that became very interesting for me was to try to understand the structure of secrecy itself. I've talked about this in a number of public presentations. Who's in charge? Who's got the control of this secret? Well, this is a big argument. No one really knows for sure, but I have my ideas, and those ideas are in this book. Is it the president? Well, we all kind of know it's not totally, truly the president, so who is it? Is it international elites of some sort? Well, I would say a short answer to that is yes. And then the third leg that this book stands on is something that became very, very interesting to me, more so as I wrote this book, and that's the evolution of research on this. In other words, you have this phenomenon that's very strange, and yet, how is it that we have interacted with it? How do we perceive it? Well, you can get this when you study the research itself. So in the early 1970s, you find that researchers are looking at this in one way. By the time we get to the end of this story, 1991, they were looking at it often in a very, very different way. And how you get from point A to point B is very fascinating. And in other words, it's a history of ufology. One thing that I studied a lot of as a younger person was what is known as history of philosophy, history of ideas, also something called historiography, the history of, well, how you do history. And in a sense, I felt that I was returning to that with this section of the book. It's a sense, it's a history of how we interact with this. And I don't really believe that there's really been a proper study of the history of ufology. And I think one of the things that's in this book is exactly that. A few other questions that come up throughout this book is the idea of military technology. In other words, when you come across a really interesting case from, say, 1975, you have to ask yourself, now, is that one of ours, or is that not one of ours? And it's hard sometimes to know the answer to that, so one thing that, again, I've tried to do in this book is to get a sense of what was the state of advanced military open technology that we know about in certain periods of time, in the mid-70s and mid-80s and so on. And what are some possibilities within the classified world, the black world? And that's basically it. And then the other theme, just as in the first book, is the continual attempt by various citizen groups to end UFO secrecy. Now, it hasn't happened. We're 60 years into this, and it still hasn't happened. But It doesn't mean that no progress has been made. There has been progress. And just like in a sporting event, if you're, I don't know, playing hockey, you're not going to score unless you get a lot of shots on goal. So the more shots you take, the better your chances are. And one thing that we can say about this is that, yes, attempts to end secrecy failed in the 1940s, and they failed in the 1950s, and they failed in the 60s and 70s and 80s and 90s and in our own century, but they've also continued every single decade. They have not stopped. So that tells me that there is something continually percolating and going on, and at a certain point, I think it's going to break. So this is the table of contents of the book. It's 9 chapters. I want to give a chat on each section briefly. Global strangeness, intruder alert. I try to have nice, pithy, cool little titles here. Great Expectations, The Empire Strikes Back. That's my favorite chapter title. Cloak and Dagger, Calm Before the Storm, Ufology Explodes, Into Dreamland and Beyond, and False Dawn. So let's chat about what's some of the main things. This is now each section of this book is a stringing together of many, many threads. I had a hard time, honestly, weaving this all together so that it was a coherent story that flows. I think it does, as best as I can make it flow. Again, there's an encyclopedic aspect of this, but then there's a story that's being told too. It's trying to walk this line. So you can see these are all of the subsections of that very first chapter, about, I guess, 20 or so. And I want to talk about some of those highlights now. So, in the early 70s, 73, 74, you find one of the things I talk about is a lot of UFO activity that was going on in Europe, particularly so in Spain. That photograph you see there is an anonymously sent photograph from 1974 to a French researcher. The argument at the time was that it had to be a hoax because the light beams coming down could not possibly end in the way that they do. Subsequently, a number of scientists have argued, no, actually, that can work just fine. Be that as may, that's the photograph, it's interesting. That document down there is one section of a Defense Intelligence Agency document describing UFOs that were being seen in Spain. Some fascinating, very detailed accounts. All of this is in the book. A very interesting statement by the Minister of Defense of France. Many people today are cognizant of Paul Hellyer, former Minister of Defense of Canada. And Mr. Hellyer has, to the great credit of himself and to the great benefit of all of us, come out publicly with his opinions and his information that he's now gathered on UFO cover-up. But what a lot of people don't realize is that this type of thing has gone on for a long time. In 1974, the acting Minister of Defense of France, he wasn't retired, he was the French Minister of Defense, did a radio interview with a journalist. This is incredible. Could you imagine 5 years ago Donald Rumsfeld doing this type of interview, talking about UFOs? I don't think so. Robert Gallet, in 1974, said that there are baffling radar/visual incidents. He said, if your listeners could see for themselves the massive reports coming in from police and military, they would see it is all pretty disturbing. He's talking about UFO reports in 1974. It made a big splash at the time among UFO researchers. The problem was it didn't extend out to the mainstream media at that time. In the very same year, another important person had a UFO connection. That's Ronald Reagan, who was governor of California at the time. Now, everyone knows that Jimmy Carter saw a UFO. Some people know Ronald Reagan saw a UFO. What a lot of people don't realize is that Ronald Reagan's UFO sighting was a lot more interesting and a lot more dramatic than Jimmy Carter's. Vastly more. And yet, it wasn't something that came out because, like when Carter ran for the White House in 1976, that's when his sighting. Everyone okay? Good. Okay. Good. I hope that wasn't me, because I'm not changing whatever I'm doing. Okay. They're here.
I just lost this. We're out.
Hello?
Hello?
We
are experiencing technical difficulties.
Should I pause or should I wait for you to fix this? Can anybody?
I'll talk. Can you hear me? Great. Do I need to speak up louder? All right. Well, this is out. I'm hearing all kinds of sparkly sounds. That's bizarre. Let's do this. How's this? Much better. Okay. I'm going to walk over here. Maybe you should just take this away. Bad microphone. Okay. So, fun times in Gaithersburg. Ronald Reagan's UFO sighting. Now, Grant Cameron has this on his site, Presidential UFO, and I got interested by reading this account. What happened is Ronald Reagan in 1974 was flying in a Cessna. He had a pilot named Bull Painter. He had a couple of aides with him, and they're out there, and they see this white object zigzagging across the sky. And Reagan said, oh, my God, let's follow it. So actually, the pilot goes after this object, which then just shot straight up in the air. Reagan got very excited about this sighting. Now, I'd been trying to track down the actual source of this for some time. I found the source. It's in a book called Landslide. It's about Reagan's second term in the White House. This is not a UFO book. This is a very political book. It deals mostly with Iran-Contra and things like this. But in the back, there's a footnote, a very long footnote. The longest footnote of the book, and it deals with this sighting. The information came to the authors by a Wall Street Journal journalist, or Washington Post, I can't recall. It was one of those. So here's what happened. 1 week after Reagan's sighting, it was in the summer of 74, he's sitting down on the airplane, on an airplane next to this journalist. And he was still obviously very pumped up over what he had seen. So he's sitting next and he's describing his UFO sighting to this Washington Post journalist. And the journalist looks at him, John Miller. He says, sir, are you telling me you believe in UFOs? And Miller wrote, he said, at that point, Reagan looked at me and he realized that he was talking to a reporter. And so he stopped and said, oh, no, I'm not saying that. It was all very interesting is all. And then that was the end of the conversation. But think of the difference between someone like Galley in France, who's, for whatever reasons, very open and forthcoming about UFOs. In the very same year, Ronald Reagan, governor of California, terrified, because he knew, rightly, that he would be roasted as a politician for describing his interest in this topic. But what he wrote, what he said to this journalist was, to our utter amazement, it went straight up into the heavens. When I got off the plane, I told Nancy all about it, and we read up on the long history of UFOs. And by the way, Reagan's pilot, Bull Painter, was also interviewed and corroborated, confirmed every single bit of this sighting. It happened. It's quite fascinating, and you don't see about it in any other biography of Reagan. Isn't that interesting? One of the other interesting sections of this first chapter of the book is the introduction of the triangles. Now, there'd been triangular craft before the early 70s, but really only sporadically, as far as we can tell. What you have in early 1975 in North Carolina is a week-long sighting of really definitive triangular and boomerang-type aircraft, such as these here. They're not necessarily the best drawings in the world, but there were many, many police officer witnesses, very detailed accounts, objects that would hover silently and then move off. All of the things that you get with typical UFO sightings. There's a lot of other interesting little tidbits of Chapter 1. I do an analysis of the Bilderbergers, believe it or not, in a UFO book. Yes, I've taken the plunge. A bit of an analysis of Gerald Ford and his relationship to that group. It's become my opinion that groups like them, I'm not saying them specifically, but I think they're probably an excellent candidate. They don't just exist off in their own little cubby hole. They have a lot to do with this. They made every single president that comes under the period of this chapter. I mean, they made Gerald Ford. They made Jimmy Carter. They tried to kill Ronald Reagan, and they made George Bush. And they So they're involved, and understanding them, when we're talking about things like disclosure and exopolitics, it seems to me it's essential to understand what our own structure of power is. Otherwise, we're spinning our wheels forever. All right, it's important to talk to people like the president, but we can't just fool ourselves into thinking that he's the guy who's going to solve all the problems, or that Congress is going to be the institution that's going to deal with it. We all want that to be the case, but let's get real here. You know, 50 years ago, when the organization NICAP was trying to end disclosure, trying to end the cover-up and obtain disclosure, back in the 1950s, you could still believe that by going to Congress, you might be able to do the right thing here. And that's what they tried to do year after year, and that's all detailed in my first volume. Well, those attempts failed. We know that. Is that the strategy today? Is Congress really the answer? Well, we want it to be. And we can still try to resuscitate that old Republican institution. But we have to recognize that there are other structures of power. So chapter 2 I call Intruder Alert, primarily because there were just so many incredible, scary, weird, freaky UFO violations of airspace that went along, particularly, most famously, the northern U.S. border in late 1975 going into Canada. But really throughout 76, you have objects that, again, we have the documentation on this. It's really crystal clear. Someone, something was doing things that should not have been going on. One of the interesting things about coming out of 1975 are the animal mutilations. I do try to treat this topic. You can't ignore it. It's part of the history. Is it related to UFOs or not? Well, I think it is. I argue why in this book. I'm not saying it has nothing to do with black ops, but I think that there's a definite UFO connection. We have the airspace violations, many, many of them. These are a couple of snippets of various documents. I've talked about this many times in the past. You have cases over at Malmstrom Air Force Base, Loring Air Force Base, Wirt Smith Air Force Base, and a number of others where objects triggered alarms going off, triggered interceptors attempting to get these things, whatever they were. In the case at Malmstrom Air Force Base in Montana, on two nights in a row, these objects were seen, tracked by NORAD, F-106s sent on intercept. The objects disappear. Ground witnesses are watching this whole thing, this whole display going on, at the same time that NORAD is tracking these objects. Whatever they were able to outperform American fighter interceptors. That in itself is interesting. Whether or not they're alien is almost secondary. Again, we need to be asking ourselves, not, oh, it's impossible for aliens to get here. Let's back up and just be empirical here and look at the evidence. The evidence shows that something has been going on and it's some unknown agency behind it. What we have to do in public when we deal with this issue is take one step at a time and not jump the gun. It's interesting enough without jumping to conclusions. A lot of new abduction cases, most famously Travis Walton in 1975. There are some others. One forgotten case, I think is quite important, is that of an Air Force sergeant named Charles Moody. I do a bit of an analysis on that case as well. What you get in the mid-70s, all of this in the same basic geography. You get the mutilations, the airspace violations, the abduction cases, and these new things, these unmarked helicopters, black helicopters. Who knows who they belong to? All in the same geographic area, all around the same time coming into play. Why? Why? Well, again, it's something that I try to deal with. I don't have every single answer here. There's something important that was happening in the American Midwest, Southwest, Western region in general that prompted this. The Iranian case. This is when Iran was still an ally of the United States in the days of the Shah, and of course many people know a lot about this case. We know about it because we have great documentation, and subsequently we're able to get outstanding testimony from some of the key people who were involved in this. One of the pilots later became a general, talked about this at length in later years. Essentially what you have is over the city of Tehran, a bunch of residents saw this bizarre light. They called into their airport, Mehrabad Airport, which then called the Iranian Air Force, which sent two F-4 aircraft, one after the other, to investigate this. In both cases, at about 25 miles distant, all of their electronic communication systems shut down as they're watching this bizarre object with this incredible light display. In the case of the second interceptor, this object dropped another object out of it, which then pursued the F-4, if you can imagine this happening. The F-4 pilot said, I'm getting out of here, pulled away. The smaller object turned inside his own arc and then rejoined with the mother craft, as it was mentioned in the memo, for a perfect rejoin. What can do that in 1976 to an American-made fighter interceptor? Good question. Throughout it all, government silence on UFOs, government silence on the mutilation cases. And in fact, in the case of the mutilation phenomenon, you get the exact same type of debunking and disinformation going on as you had a decade earlier with the infamous Condon Committee report. So that, in other words, by the late 70s, the state of New Mexico commissioned a retired FBI agent, a gentleman named Kenneth Rommel, to lead an investigation on these mutilation cases. And very much like Edward Condon from a decade earlier, went into the study thinking it was all nonsense. He had a preconceived conclusion right from the outset. And unfortunately for the phenomenon, fortunately for the cattle, mutilation cases dropped way, way down during the year of his study. Good for the cattle, bad for us, because it made it, you know, when he did his conclusion, it was, well, it's all coyotes and natural predators doing it. And the evidence, I argue, is not at all that, in the least. The third chapter I call Great Expectations. Why? Well, there were great expectations. You have the election of Jimmy Carter in 1976, a man who was believed by many to be someone who would end UFO secrecy. This is a widespread belief. I think it was very much a mistaken belief, but it was widespread at the time. There were reasons for believing it, and then there were some illusions behind that. So let's deal with that. First, the big year, 1977, Carter's first year in the White House, we have the struggle that did occur within the White House to get NASA to be the lead organization in accepting UFO reports from the public, kind of like being a new Project Blue Book. NASA attitude throughout was no way, no how, no thank you, sir. And they were supported in this by the CIA. Didn't happen. We have another reason for great expectations. The leaks that were coming to a researcher by the name of Leonard Stringfield. I'm sure there are many people in this room who knew Leonard Stringfield. I did not have the pleasure. What happened was he wrote a book in 1977 called Red, my mind is just drawing a blank now. Situation Red, in which he took a number of crash retrieval stories, leaked accounts of inside, claims of I saw an alien body and so on and so on. This kind of stuff had really not been in UFO research at all up to the mid-70s. I mean, it had come out very briefly in the early 50s and then was immediately debunked and it just went away. Any claims of crash retrievals and alien bodies was forbidden among UFO researchers until Leonard Stringfield put himself out there. He wrote a couple of these accounts in this book, and as a result, the fact that Carter was now in the White House, the fact that Stringfield had put this book out, people went to Leonard Stringfield. And before you know it, he's collecting dozens and then scores of these accounts. They weren't provable, but they were interesting. The wife of a deceased person would say, my husband told me about when he was at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and saw alien bodies. Or someone who would say, I was involved in the retrieval of a wreckage of an alien vehicle, and so on and so on. And Stringfield began to collect these, and it looked like something could happen. It looked like it might break. Stringfield kept very, very quiet about it for a little while, but was collecting his evidence. So there was a lot of reason for hope. Then we had the Grenada Initiative. That's Sir Eric Gary, who was Prime Minister of Grenada. A forgotten but great figure in the history of ufology. Gary, like Carter, like Ronald Reagan, had seen a UFO and was you know, fascinated by what he'd seen. So he never let this go. And now he's prime minister of this little island of Grenada. Well, who cares about Grenada? That was the good thing. Because no one cared what the leader of Grenada thought, right? It mattered if you were the president of the United States. You had to be very careful about what you said. But Grenada, you had some more leeway. So what Eric Gehry did was to use the United Nations as his bully pulpit, as it were. Because he had access to the UN. And he thought, I'm going to bring the UFO issue up at the United Nations, and I'm going to get some forward motion on this. We're going to start an investigative group, or we're going to do whatever we can. And so for a couple of years, Eric Gehry tried to get an initiative at the United Nations. And he succeeded in getting a UN resolution passed, which in its own lukewarm way endorsed the idea of further investigating the UFO phenomenon. It didn't go anywhere. But it was a big thing at the time. And Eric Gehry, by the way, was ousted in a coup d'etat I believe, early 1979, after continually attempting to get this UN initiative going. And you know, the interesting thing about his coup is that he was ousted by a Marxist group, a man named Maurice Bishop, who himself was ousted 4 years later in the Reagan administration's invasion of Grenada, if you recall that. And you have to wonder, I don't know if we'll ever truly know the story on this, but you've got to wonder why Gehry was ousted in a Marxist coup. Could it be, I only wonder, that this was allowed by U.S. national security community? Let the Marxists get in there. We'll take them out soon enough anyway. Meanwhile, we'll get rid of this nuisance, Eric Gehry. I can only wonder. One thing we can say about Eric Gehry is that he tried to get Jimmy Carter to support his initiative at the United Nations, and Carter absolutely would not do that. Aerial UFO encounters in the mid-late 70s, good grief, it just was a nonstop story. It's an incredible, honestly. I mean, just every single month, if the major news media had covered these aerial encounters the way we now know they all happened, It would have caused an upheaval, which is obviously why they were not covered. This is actually just a paragraph that I lifted from my book. This is not a military encounter, but it's typical of what was going on at the time. And I'll just read it. On December 8, 1977, two UFO sightings occurred near Oxnard, California. At 8 p.m., air traffic controllers tracked four unidentified objects about 3 to 5 miles north of Laguna Peak. Quote, "We watched the targets on the scope for nearly 3 hours," said one controller. The speed and maneuverability of the objects caused one controller to remark, quote, "I've never seen anything like this in all the 20 years that I have worked as an air traffic controller." At around 9 p.m., while the controllers were still tracking the UFOs, a Golden West commuter aircraft was flying from Oxnard to Los Angeles International Airport when two large bright lights maneuvered around it for 15 minutes. The speed and maneuverability of these objects was described as extraordinary. Quote, "Like you would just snap your finger and it was there," said the commercial pilot. It got so close, it scared the hell out of me. On and on and on. So we have air safety issues. If nothing else, we have the issue of, you know, most of you probably flew to get here, or a lot of you did. And how often does this go on? It seems to me that in a lot of ways, the secrecy is better today, even in the age of the internet, than it was in the 70s. And I think that's because we're in post 9/11, and there's a lot more control over what commercial pilots say in public. And you talk to commercial pilots, I'm sure there are many in the audience here, I have no doubt that they will confirm there's a tremendous amount of pressure on them not to talk about the encounters that they have. Another topic I cover in this book, there's just one of, you know, 50 or 100 minefields that I had to deal with in doing this book. They're everywhere. There are so many controversial topics, I really couldn't avoid any of them. And I have no doubt that no one will be pleased by every single one that I've covered. I mean, there's going to be someone, you'll find something annoying that I've done that you will have to disagree with. The shooting at Fort Dix. many of you know of this. This is, some people believe this happened, others don't. I do believe that this happened. Now, the case was early 1978, Fort Dix it's in New Jersey. You had UFO sightings over it, and the story is that an alien was shot by a military policeman and was dead on the field. It borders an Air Force base right next to it. At that base, incidentally, was a gentleman named George Filer, major at the time. George Filer is well known to many researchers. He's got a weekly Filer's Files that he puts out. George Filer's part of this story and interviewed the gentleman who is the primary witness of, under the pseudonym of Jeffrey Morse. Long story short, this case was analyzed by the National Institute of Discovery Science, and it is my opinion that NIDS bungled this investigation. They didn't interview Filer. They didn't interview Jeffrey Morse. They interviewed a bunch of Air Force guys and Army guys who were towing the party line. Well, what do you expect them to say? I think this shooting happened. You can read why in my book, which, by the way, isn't available today, but will be, I think, within about 2 months from now. So it'll be at the website or Amazon. 1978, you have what I would call a global pandemic of UFOs. It was an intense year. Now, anyone who's a movie buff will know that Steven Spielberg's Close Encounters of the Third Kind came out during that year. Believe it or not, there were skeptics who attributed this whole wave of sightings to Steven Spielberg. It's all his fault. People saw Close Encounters, and, well, you know, they just got excited by the, you know, Ferris wheel that's in town, or who knows. Well, guess what? When you look at these sightings in detail, it just doesn't make sense. You can't blame this on Steven Spielberg. There were many sightings that year of what were then called humanoids. This is before the word alien really became common parlance. Humanoids. There's a researcher who's got on his website a collection of humanoid sightings from 1978, over 300 from the year. There's a lot of detail in some of those. I'm not saying they're all genuine, but they're very interesting, and some of them have the right feel to it, in my opinion. But that's only part of the picture. You had enormous numbers of, again, aerial encounters by commercial and military pilots with these objects. It was hot and heavy all through the year. And then we get the Freedom of Information Act kicking in 1978. FOIA, F-O-I-A. FOIA had been passed originally in 1966, but it didn't really have teeth until the mid-late 70s, went through certain changes. By 1978, it was going full guns. And at that point, researchers were getting thousands of pages of documents from the government, not hundreds, thousands of pages, from the FBI, from the Defense Intelligence Agency, from the CIA, from even from NSA, which was fighting all the way, releasing blank pages or blacked out pages. But all the agencies are releasing documents relating to UFOs. And the excitement at the time, and I was rather young and wasn't following this, but when you review the literature, it's obvious. This was an electrifying period for UFO research because it looked like just as Leonard Stringfield was getting his leaks of crash retrievals, so too UFO researchers were getting these documents. And the documents were confirmed. They weren't disputed like the later MJ-12 documents were. These, there's nothing you can argue with. They didn't have a single smoking gun. There wasn't a confirmed memo from the president that says, well, what do we do about these aliens? But there were a number of documents that were one cut below that described a number of these airspace violations and military encounters, and they're perplexing, to say the least. And so it looked as though there might be a way to break this secrecy. So what happened? Well, what happened was that the empire struck back, starting around 1979. And what I believe happened, and I argue in this book, that there is evidence for a kind of counterattack, counterintelligence action against UFO research. These, as you can see, these are the various subsets of that chapter. Let me just now move on to some of the highlights of that chapter. The David versus Goliath battle of cause that is citizens against UFO secrecy, against the NSA. I alluded to that just a moment ago. It's an interesting part of the history of this. You have this tiny little group with no money, practically no people, fighting the National Security Agency over their UFO documents. And for those of you who have no idea, I mean, we're right outside D.C., so I assume everyone knows what the NSA is, but they are, of all known intelligence agencies, certainly the biggest and baddest and most well-funded of all American intelligence groups, and certainly the most secretive. They don't call it no such agency for nothing. So basically, all that happened was that Cause learned that the NSA had 100 to 200 various UFO documents. They learned that they had a little over 100 documents and said, well, we want to get those documents. NSA said, no, you ain't. And then they took it to court. Not only were the documents not released, but the judge was given a list of reasons by the NSA why they shouldn't be released, and those reasons were classified. 25 or so page affidavit. The lawyers for Cause, Peter Gersten, primarily said, well, may I read the affidavit? Judge said, no, you can't. That's classified. So not only am I not releasing the documents to you, but I can't tell you why I'm not going to release them to you. They were later released almost entirely blacked out, you know, for years. That's all anyone could see with these blacked out. And primarily even today, they're still mostly blacked out. Another section of this chapter is the breakout of the Roswell story. It's easy to forget these things, that Roswell wasn't always known to people. I mean, it came out briefly as a flash in the pan in 1947, then it just died. It went away. They said, oh, it was a weather balloon, no big thing. And for 30 years, that was the case, until researchers, Stanton Friedman, and also Leonard Stringfield, and a few others started looking into Roswell, and then Bill Moore. And they broke the story. It came out in 1980. There's a lot of odd things about how that story broke, incidentally. I'm not really sure, even to this day, if I've got a full handle on the behind-the-scenes machinations. For example, how did it happen that Bill Moore and his co-author, Charles Berlitz, who, by the way, was not just a language guy but worked for 26 years in counterintelligence, how is it that they were able to get National Enquirer promotion of their book a full 6 months before they came out? I mean, I would love to get promotion of my book in a major. I think most researchers who don't have access to money or avenues of distribution or media would love to get great publicity like this. Moore and Berlitz were able to get massive promotion of their book before it happened in the National Enquirer, which, as Terry Hansen pointed out in his seminal work on UFOs and media, The Missing Times, that the publisher of the National Enquirer, a gentleman named Gene Pope, was himself once CIA and mafia, actually, and was a very well-connected man. He was close with Defense Secretary Melvin Laird. How does the National Enquirer publisher get such important friends? Pope once said, well, one hand washes the other. What does that mean? The Enquirer was doing some kind of work on UFOs. And what I believe the work was, incidentally, was a way to disable the topic by putting in some true UFO stories, which the Enquirer did do. They had Bob Pratt, a good journalist. He did some good research there. They also put in some demonstrably false UFO stories in there. And they packaged it all in this ridiculous tabloid format that no one would take seriously. So what does that do? Well, the best form of disinformation isn't just to lie. You take something that's true and you package it in such a way that it becomes useless. The Manzano story and the Paul Benowitz story. I spent a lot of time on this. I felt it was necessary. I've never been happy with the predominant interpretation of Paul Benowitz's story for the last few years, and I feel that a corrective is necessary, and I think that I have it in this book. Paul Benowitz was a defense-oriented scientist, a very brilliant man, who lived right across from Kirtland Air Force Base in the Manzano Weapons Storage Area in Albuquerque. Started seeing and seeing bizarre things over Kirtland. They looked like UFOs. He thought, well, that's interesting. And he started, because he had all this instrumentation, he started getting these signals, electromagnetic signals and audio signals, and thinking, well, what are those? Well, he started to interpret them. Now, how did he interpret these signals? Well, it's an interesting question. I've been looking into this. But the long and short of it is that he believed he was getting alien communications about a base under Dulce's Archuleta Peak. Now, what actually happened with Paul Benowitz? Was he getting things relating to UFOs, or was he getting other kinds of exotic but totally terrestrial technologies? And, as has been argued, was it simply that the Air Force and NSA and who knows who else targeted him for disinformation so that he wouldn't delve any further into those matters? Well, what I believe is that Paul Benowitz was getting exactly what he thought to a certain extent. He was getting UFO-related signals, photographs, and intelligence. I have a lot of new information on Paul Benowitz for this book. I had some of Benowitz's notes that I had access to, not a lot, but enough. I also spoke with a very good friend of Paul Benowitz, Ron Regere, who some of you know Ron. Ron and Paul were quite close in the 1980s. I believe that because Paul Benowitz was getting bizarre signals, he might have been tapping into various ET-related communications programs. I think that's entirely possible. He was targeted to be the subject of disinformation. William Moore, researcher in UFOs at the time, was taken on by Air Force intelligence and who knows who else, frankly, to pass certain falsified documents on to Benowitz. Why would he do that? Well, I assume that if Benowitz were to promote those documents, he would be discredited through them. The Cash Landrum case. Interesting case. This is these are photographs of, there's Betty Cash on the bottom and then Vicki Landrum and her grandson Colby. These three people were driving near Huffman, Texas one evening in December 1980. They encountered this diamond-like UFO that was intensely bright, intensely hot. They got out of their car. Betty Cash got out for the longest. She actually walked toward this thing. Colby got upset and his grandmother took him back in, but Betty was out there. She got exposed for the longest. They all had radiation sickness. Betty tried to get back into the car and burned her hand on the knob. This is December. This thing was intensely hot. She became ill. She lost her hair. She had all kinds of medical problems. John Schussler, UFO researcher and aviation, he worked at McDonnell Douglas, tried to be her advocate. They got nowhere. Try to take this to court. No one would claim this object. The object was accompanied by over 20 helicopters that were in the vicinity. So either this was our object or our guys knew all about it. No one would talk. What was that object? Was it an experimental craft of one of ours? I think that's probably the best bet. To this day, it's never been acknowledged. The Rendlesham case. The more you look at this case, the more you have to be convinced that it's just one of the most extraordinary events in the history of the last 100 years of anything. Part of the problem with the Rendlesham case is the dates that were indicated by Colonel Charles Halt in his original memo, which caused all kinds of confusion. Those dates aren't exactly right. And so researching this case is really a pain in the neck because you have to figure out what is the exact chronology. How do all of the accounts fit together? It's hard to know. I don't think anybody really knows for sure, even to this day. But what we can say very confidently is that on at least two occasions, at the end of 1980, at the American-operated, British-owned bases near the Rendlesham Forest, an object came down. Lots of witnesses were there. This was not a lighthouse. This was nothing conventional. It was, I would argue, certainly not from our civilization. Were they from another planet? Were they from another dimension? Were they from another time? I don't know, but it's something that's not us. That much I think you can take to the bank. It's one of the longest subsections in my book. I've spoken with a number of investigators on this, not all, but there's been a lot of information that's available. I know Larry Warren. I've talked quite a bit to him, and I will tell you that there's no doubt in my mind that Larry Warren is truthful with what he says he encountered. I've read the accounts. I've seen video of all the other major actors, players involved in this, and something came down. And to this day, I think, has been not fully and totally understood. Just a week ago, I was chatting with Linda Moulton Howe, who has been doing, has been helping Jim Peniston, one of the witnesses in this, to undergo hypnotic regression on what it was he encountered. And the tape of that regression is available. You can see it. Linda has it, at least in her presentations. And all I can say is that it looks very much that Jim Peniston is still experiencing a great deal of trauma from what he encountered 25, 29 years ago now, and that there's something else going on. It looks like it's an extraterrestrial encounter. The fifth chapter I call Cloak and Dagger. I don't know how far behind I am, but we're going to run over, and that's just all there is to it. These are the subsections of Cloak and Dagger. Some interesting things going on here. A lot on ufology itself. Some new information coming out. The beginning of the Hudson Valley phenomenon. The very beginning of the Hestalen phenomenon as well in Norway. One of the most interesting and somewhat forgotten cases, except among ufologists, I guess, is the Trans-en-Provence case. You know, what's interesting is just a couple of weeks after Britain's most famous UFO case, you get France's most amazing and well-documented, possibly, UFO case in this place called Trans-en-Provence. A farmer comes out, he sees this landed object. That's kind of what it looked like. The reason this is well-documented is because after the object took off, it left very particular ground traces, which were analyzed by the French government UFO agency, GEPAN, conducted an extensive analysis of the soil, of the plant around it, all showing a lack of chlorophyll in the area, dried out soil for months afterward. Strange effects on the plant itself. It's an interesting case. Abduction debate really starts to take off in the early 80s. This is another transformation of ufology. Sure, everyone knew, even back in the 60s, that every now and then it appeared a person might get abducted by these beings. But it was thought to be a kind of occasional peripheral aspect of the phenomenon. It wasn't really until the late 70s, and then with Bud Hopkins' book, Missing Time, that you really get this debate brought front row center of ufology. And what Bud Hopkins argued, really for the first time, was that this phenomenon is much more widespread than basically at that point there were maybe 200 or so cases that had been researched. Not a lot. What Bud Hopkins argued is that this is vastly more widespread than that. And then the other thing that he said is that you had a lot of repeater abductions. In fact, I think he said that this is the norm, that once you're taken, they're going to take you again and again. And so you know, not everyone bought into this right away. There was a very big argument about it among researchers. And to this day, of course, you still get it. It was, I think, a much more intense argument at the time when it was a brand new concept. There were many people who felt that ufology was somewhat in retreat at this time. I mean, what basically happened was, after all those great expectations of the late 70s, when you get to the 1980s, you get changes in, for example, by 1982, President Reagan made significant changes to the Freedom of Information Act, made it a lot less user-friendly, a lot more expensive, removed time constraints on the timeliness of agencies to get back to you. So in other words, now it could just take forever, and that would drive the costs of your request way up. That was problem number one. Problem number two is that sightings dropped in the early 80s. Problem number three is that all of the other inroads into breaking secrecy, not just FOIA, but a lot of the leaks. Leonard Stringfield had more and more trouble with his leaks. Many of them said, I'm not allowed to talk to you anymore. You start getting a lot of active debunking by the organization PSYCOP, Committee on Scientific Investigations, Claims of the Paranormal. Philip Klass, the most effective debunker. PSYCOP didn't do a good job at all of true scientific analysis of UFOs. Far from it. Far from it. They were a propaganda organization from the beginning. But that's what made them effective. They had outstanding connections to the media. And they were able, really far better than ufology, at getting their message to places like the Washington Post and mainstream media. They were great at that. And it started to be felt in the early 1980s. The National Enquirer connections, I referred to that earlier, so I'll skip past it, but it became an issue by the early 80s. Researchers were thinking, you know, what are we doing with this Enquirer? Is this really a good thing? I think it really wasn't a good thing. Although there were leading UFO researchers who felt that it was. The leaders of APRO, the Lorenzans, believed that it was a good thing. Even Walt Andres of MUFON thought it was a good thing. I think the attitude was, well, we'll just, you know, publicity is hard enough in this field. Any kind of, there's no such thing as bad publicity, right? Well, maybe there is. There's an argument you can make on both sides of this. Chapter 6, I call The Calm Before the Storm. This is, there's a lot going on here. This book was, it's just pulling together, literally there's 200 or 250 of these little subsections that I've tried to pull together, each standard article length primarily. So let's go into this. The Hessdalen phenomenon. Hessdalen is in the middle of Norway. There's nothing there. It's in a valley. You could literally hear a tractor or a car 2 or 3 miles away in this place because there's nothing. There's no major cities there. What would happen, though, is in this isolated part of Norway, people started noticing these bizarre light phenomena. What were these things? Well, to this day, there's really no true explanation. Go to the Hessdalen website and you can... There are still Hessdalen researchers, and in fact, there's still a phenomenon going on there, according to the researchers at the site. Although certainly the phenomenon really was at its peak in the 80s in terms of the activity and the attention it got. These are just a couple of photographs. And you'd have these dedicated guys and women going out there in the bitter cold weather, camping out with their radar equipment and all other types of electronic measuring devices to track this stuff. And they got a lot. They got enough to show definitively that there is a bizarre, apparently intelligently controlled phenomenon there. It wasn't always just light. Sometimes this was tracked on radar. Whatever these things were, they would go slow, they would go fast, they would stop, they would meander, then they would just move off with apparent intelligent control. If you want to get an idea on what was the leading edge of scientific ufology of the time, this was it. I think the work done at Hessdalen was about the best you could do. An elusive phenomenon that evaded any kind of characterization, dedicated researchers tracking it and recording it. And not jumping to conclusions, by the way, either. And still, it was a very difficult thing to figure out what was going on there.